The month in review, we discuss Maine news headlines from February. When Governor LePage gave his final State of the State address on February 13th, he talked about a lot of topics, from conservation land to Medicaid expansion, tax conformity to student loans. In fact, the speech lasted almost an hour and a half. But among the topics the governor did not mention are two that garnered big headlines this month: the fate of the Downeast Correctional Facility and the state's opioid epidemic. Later in the month, we learned that 418 Maine people died last year due to overdoses, a number even higher than the year before. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss the stories of the month: new salmon farms, a change in L.L. Bean's famous return policy, a proposed tax break for BIW's parent company. What stories mattered to you? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Even with only 28 days, February has had no shortage of big news stories, from school safety issues to alarming numbers of opioid deaths to the latest efforts by Governor LePage. We have plenty of issues to discuss, and joining me today are illustrious panel of editorial page editors. Susan Young is in our Bangor studio. She's with the Bangor Daily News. Here with me in Portland, Greg Kesich with the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram, and Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. As always, we want to hear from you. What news made an impression on you this month? Do you have a reaction to what's happening in Augusta? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for coming back. Susan Young, I'm going to start with school safety. Just today, news of two more Maine schools dealing with things. In Rockland, a middle school student charged with what seems to be trash talking, but still talking about guns. And in Skowhegan, classes canceled today. This follows what happened in Ellsworth and Cape Elizabeth. Where does this end?
That's a very good question. I don't think we know where it ends. But what's so remarkable to me is the difference after the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida. I mean, these kids are speaking out. They're not backing down, even when they're getting death threats, which is horrifying. But it feels like maybe something, anything, might happen after this shooting, which hasn't happened after the dozens of other horrific shootings we've had. So it's just so interesting that I think because of these students, things are happening. Today, Dick's Sporting Goods announced that they will no longer sell assault-style rifles or ammunition, and they'll only sell guns to people who are over the age of 21. So, you know, for those of us who support more gun control, there's some hope that things will be different this time around.
Well, and Dick's Sporting Goods is different than a lot of other gun dealers in that a large part, if not most of its profit margin, is from high school athletes buying things like cleats and soccer balls and lacrosse sticks and things like that. It's different than a store that primarily sells firearms. Ben, have you been following the legislature? We hear a lot about what's going on in other state legislatures, possible new gun laws. What about here in Maine?
Yeah, the Legislative Council, the group of legislative leaders that at this point in the session have to decide if any new bills are introduced, met this week. And they said yes to a safety bond, money that might go out to school, be available to schools to make safety improvements. They said yes to what's called a red flag law, which gives families and police a little extra ability to act when someone around them is acting in a worrisome manner. So those are going to go forward and be debated among the larger legislature. It doesn't look like any of the gun control bills went forward. There was or gun-related bills, I should say. They said no to arming teachers, which is, you know, part of this debate, and they said no to banning high-capacity rounds. So it looks like this debate going forward is going to be really about school safety in the sense of infrastructure. What can you do to make a school safer by building things around it? And then mental health.
Greg, does this feel to you different than in the wake of other horrible school shootings?
It, you know, in some ways it does. I covered the town of Sanford after the Columbine shootings. And at that time, there was a lot of great tension, mostly among the adults, I remember. The teachers were really freaked out. And the kids didn't seem to think it was that big a deal. I think what we have now is a generation of kids who have seen repeated school shootings and then inaction by adults. And in the meantime, they're all being put through drills where they have to practice hiding and running and in general just like acting out this event. So it's very easy for them to imagine when they see an event like this that it could happen to them. This occurred to me the other day. We got a little sheet of paper from HR giving us, you know, 10 tips of what to do when the active shooter shows up in the newsroom. And it was like the first time I ever thought, wow, this could really happen, you know. And so I think kids are growing up with that mindset, and I think the what we're seeing in terms of some of these schools where they have to shut down for the day is and actually the original part of that story was Sanford. Somebody called it a bomb threat for every day for a month after after Columbine, and they kept shutting school down. But the problem with looking for red flags is there's lots and lots of red flags. You can't, in retrospect, you look at this kid and you think, wow, how could they not have stopped him? How could they not have seen, I'm talking about the kid in Florida, how troubled he was. But my guess is there's lots of troubled kids.
Yeah.
And police are kind of overwhelmed with reports that he might commit a crime.
Hmm. I want to move on to another really serious topic. Ben Bragdon, we now know that the number of opioid-related deaths, the number of overdoses in Maine last year, even higher than the year before. And the year before was shocking because it was an average of one a day. So now we've got, 418 deaths, 11% increase over the year before, most of them with multiple kinds of drugs found in the system of the people who have died upon autopsy. You know, there is a lot going on. Yesterday, the Chief Justice asked for funding for a special drug court. The governor's added treatment beds in the jail in Windham. OxyContin will no longer be marketed to doctors in Maine. But somehow it all doesn't even start to be enough, does it?
Well, no. I mean, we certainly have not here in Maine or just about anywhere else in this country met this problem with a response that matches the size of it. I mean, you talk about 418 deaths, but how many thousands of Mainers are dealing with this every day and having their families deal with it every day and having their families worried about overdoses and all the other crime that comes along with it and all the other problems that come along with it. So this is a massive problem that the overdose deaths are just a kind of final symptom of it. And you know, we just haven't done enough here in Maine. I mean, we can concentrate on what we're doing here, and we are, you know, by some measure 6-7 years into this, and we've really done very little. We've kind of nipped around the edges to add things, and when we do add treatment beds, it's a tiny fraction of what is needed. And there's just so many more things we could be doing, and we just haven't been doing them so far.
Greg, I was struck by the fact that the governor did not mention the opioid epidemic in his State of the State address.
Right. I mean, I think what Ben is pointing out to is a total lack of leadership from the governor and his administration. The governor has fought against extending Medicaid eligibility and talked about not wanting to give Medicaid to what he calls able-bodied people. Well, a lot of these people we're talking about are technically able-bodied. They don't have a disability, but they desperately need health care. And rather than extend this program with federal money, the governor set up a special treatment program that was designed to target people who don't have health insurance through Medicaid and get them into these what they call health homes and get into treatment. They've had $4.8 million budget to work with for a year. They were supposed to treat 400 people, including 170 uninsured. They've succeeded in spending $60,000 treating 50 Medicaid patients and five uninsured people. Only five. And that's, we're talking 6 years into this crisis, and the governor doesn't even bother to mention it in a speech about what the state's challenges are. He talked more about 18-year-olds not being able to buy cigarettes.
Susan. And then in his press release, you know, 2 days after the report from the attorney general telling us how many overdose deaths there were in 2017, the governor talked about faith-based treatment, talked about educating middle school kids. His administration cut the reimbursement rate for medication-assisted treatment, which research shows is the most effective form of treatment. They put time limit caps on medication-assisted treatment and taking very simple steps of undoing those bad policies would at least help. It's not going to solve the problem, but would help move Maine in the right direction. But as Ben and Greg said, you know, we've done very little to try and solve this problem.
And I think Ben made a good point when he said tip of the iceberg is the deaths, because for every person who's addicted, often there's a child involved, whether that child ends up being without parents or with parents who are unable to be effective parents.
Yeah, it's a far-reaching problem that it's really hard to underestimate how big the scope is. And you mentioned the beds at the Wyndham Prison that the governor suggested, and that kind of really encapsulates this problem. I mean, he's had this plan for a while, and he keeps talking about it, but there is no specific plan moving forward for how to do that. So it's just kind of been sitting, well, it's not even sitting on a shelf because it's not a plan. It's just something he mentions every once in a while. And he says that the legislature won't let him do it or won't get in the way, yet the legislators have never really seen a plan to move forward with. Yet we've seen the governor, when he really wants to do something, just do it. You know, he closed.
Like at the Downey's Correctional Facility.
Exactly. He just went in there at 4 o'clock in the morning and cleaned it out. And so we know he has the ability and the will to act when he doesn't get his way. It's just what he chooses to use that power on. And he has not chosen to go after this problem in any way. It's interesting that the Trump budget proposed allowing states to use to expand Medicaid in order to use that money specifically for addiction treatment, which is a great idea if it ever sees the light of day. That's something that states could do that are having this problem. They could ask for a waiver from the feds to do that sort of thing, and that'd be a really good way to tackle a huge chunk of this problem. But it takes a little bit of effort on the part of the governor, and we just haven't seen it.
If you'd like to join the conversation about the stories that mattered to you in the month of February, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can email us at talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Greg, a lot of news this month on the economic development front. Great news from Millinocket. Also news from Belfast and Bucksport. The group R. Katahdin is making things happen, it sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, we've been saying for years that we need to look beyond the traditional products that were made out of our forest, that the forest is still very valuable, but that it may not be in the way that it has been in the past, you know, in terms of making, newsprint, or which is very important. I think everybody should remember that we need, you know.
But, says our panel of newspaper.
Yeah. I think we can all agree.
Editorial page editors.
So this idea of being able to use low-quality softwoods to make really strong construction members, I'm sorry, I'm not using the right term, but I think replacing steel and concrete in construction is great, and it is a promises a real future for this former mill town. The agriculture, sort of the next generation agriculture, is not the the kind that we saw, 20 years ago that led to problems with contamination. It's not in the, they're pulling water into the facility. I think, what is it, Belfast and Bucksport?
Bucksport, right.
And they have, they are projecting a lot of jobs.
Yeah, and Susan, I know this is big news for both towns, but especially Bucksport that lost its mill.
Right, absolutely. To have the redevelopment of the mill, we met with the town manager and obviously very excited about that. And talking about the expected growth in fish consumption in America, it's pretty amazing. I think something I wasn't aware of. And so they not only jobs to begin with, but they foresee a lot of expansion to meet the demand for fish for people to consume. And Maine is in a really good position to meet that need. Cold water is important. We did talk to them about energy prices, one of the governor's top pet peeves. And, yes, prices are higher here, but they're going to save a lot of money on other things like not having to chill the water. They're close to the market. And so they saw a lot of advantages. So, two really good hopefully success stories with aquaculture.
I remember
in communities that need a boost.
Yeah, we hosted a Maine Calling program a couple of years ago on salmon farming. And at the time, I remember it was said that the gold standard was going to be, in the future, land-based salmon aquaculture. And it seemed at the time like that was going to be something far in the future. And now two different companies talking about building facilities in Maine. Ben, before we take a break, though, I want to talk about another economic story, the controversial proposal for a $60 million tax break for BIW's parent company, General Dynamics. What do we know about where that is in the legislature?
Well, they tabled it for a little bit yesterday, I believe. They're going to go back and talk about it. I mean, this is a tough one that kind of reveals a lot of the problems we have with economic development. I mean, I think most Mainers would agree that Bath Iron Works is an asset to this state, that it's a huge employer, it spends a lot of money. But at the other hand, their parent company is very rich, makes a lot of money, billions of dollars, and they pay their CEO $21 million a year, and we're going to give them Maine tax money to make this that they say they need, although we're not sure. And, every time we give out this money, we're never quite sure what it does. We're not very good at measuring whether, it makes a difference or not. And then we get roped into it because they say we need to compete. We need these jobs. Are you against that? And lawmakers just kind of fold and go with it. And meanwhile, the competitor, the Mississippi, the Bath Iron Works of the South down
Ingalls.
In Mississippi, is doing the same thing. And they're getting even more in the way of tax breaks. They're built on public land. And so we're kind of forced to match Mississippi's bad economic development policies, where they just throw money at people and don't really measure what it's doing. And, I don't blame people if they feel like they're being a little held hostage by the whole thing. So it's a tough, it's a extremely tough decision for the lawmakers to make.
On that note, we have to take our first break. When we come back, your comments and questions. We're talking about the month in review. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do C.N. Brown Energy, proud to support the Maine High School Basketball Championship Weekend on Maine Public Television, March 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. And Camp Elsing, a Maine summer camp for kids with high-functioning autism and other social challenges. CampElsing.com.
Switzerland had some of the highest heroin rates in Europe. That is, until the country decided to destigmatize it.
The results in Switzerland have been extraordinary. There have been zero deaths on overdose on the legal heroin program since it began more than 15 years ago.
Ideas about stigma and its consequences, next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
The TED Radio Hour is tonight at 11 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public is looking for a new CTO, a Chief Technology Officer, based in our Bangor office. All things technical at Maine Public includes information technology, infrastructure, and radio and television broadcast systems. If the tech world resonates with you or anyone you might know, please visit mainepublic.org, click on About, and then Careers. You'll find more information and application materials. We're hoping to hear from candidates by March 18th. And thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, The Month in Review, with me in the studio, Ben Bragdon, who is editorial page editor with the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel, and Greg Kesich, editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. And joining us from our Bangor studio, Susan Young, who is editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll start in Cherryfield with Pete. Hi, Pete. Go ahead.
Oh, hey, Jennifer. Thank you for doing this program. Thanks to all of your participants there. I'm calling about the opioid crisis. It just upsets me, who knows children that are victims of parent ODs and all the people I know in recovery, that we have such a fragmented, inconsistent, non-comprehensive approach to this in our state. No one seems to be in charge. And those in charge, when they do call meetings together, seem to miss, in my view, important constituents in this whole epidemic. I've worked with young addicts and alcoholics for 20 years, and there are many of us who are tremendous resources, and we sit there and we say, nobody asks us. We know a lot about how to get people into treatment and keep them in treatment and how to save kids, and yet we seem to be ignored because whoever's in charge just doesn't have a comprehensive picture.
You know, you use the term epidemic, and we use it a lot in our writing as kind of a metaphor for what's going on. But in a lot of ways, this is an infectious disease that you have people who have this problem that are spreading it. And the best way to stop that is to get them on medicine, get them to stop trafficking in drugs, you know, to cover their own use, and get them to stop dealing with dealers and getting their lives together. So on a very basic level, it really is like an epidemic, I mean, like an infectious epidemic.
Yeah, you know, if this was if we had a huge uptick in heart attacks or cancer of some sort, we would address it in that sense. We would get doctors and experts together, and we would ask them what to do, and then we would figure it out. But there's so much emotion around this, and different feelings about what it means to be addicted to something, or who these people are. There's that just kind of skews the conversation. You know, there's the governor, you know, has talked about people who overdose over and over and over again, and not wanting to perpetuate that, and that kind of goes against everything we know on the healthcare side of things. Yet, because he's in the position he is, he can stop that. And we have that kind of situation throughout this problem that's kind of kept us from having a comprehensive plan for it. And until that changes, I can't see us really getting a handle on it.
Yeah, what Ben and Greg are saying without actually saying it, the governor frames this so much as a personal failing.
Yeah.
Those who are addicted to drugs, those who overdose, they're failures. They can't get their act together. And if only they were better people, they wouldn't have this problem. And we know that that certainly is not the case. I mean, sometimes it feels like window dressing, but if the governor was really serious, he could have created an opiate cabinet and, you know, had DHHS take a role, bring together, as Pete said, folks that know what the best approaches are, make sure they're all meeting together, working together, moving in the same direction. But because he sees these people, you know, frankly, as just losers, I don't think there's been a motivation to take this as seriously as it demands.
We'll go to Tom calling from Scarborough. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I just want to say that I am a conservative who is not a fan of the NRA. I think a lot of the arguments they put forth in their never-ending quest to prevent any restrictions on gun ownership, most of their arguments border on the insane, as far as I'm concerned. You know, the way they take the Second Amendment and distort it from its original meaning, and they hold it up as if it's sacrosanct and it was written by the hand of God, it repulses me. And in some level, the blood that was spilled in Florida recently, just that most recent example, some of that is on the hands of the leadership of the NRA. Regardless what the Second Amendment may say, this country is awash in weapons, and you need a license to do pretty much anything in this country that you handle dangerous work, propane installment, electrical lines. I think the bar should be much higher for gun ownership. Just the fact that you have a pulse and it enables you to buy any weapon pretty much that you want, it shouldn't be that easy. I mean, the bar should be much higher for gun ownership. I'm all for gun rights. I think people should be eligible to apply for one if they meet certain criteria. But the NRA is just over the top. And I'm one conservative who is not a supporter. And I'd love to see every high school in America take one day and walk out because they are taking these abstract concepts and putting them above the lives of our children today.
Sure. Sure. And Tom, I know that on March 14th, a whole bunch of high schools around the country, kids are planning a walkout at 10 o'clock for 17 minutes. I want to ask you, what would you like to see the Maine legislature do? Oh, shoot. We lost Tom. So I guess he can't tell us. You guys want to respond? Susan, want to respond to what Tom had to say?
I mean, I think he's absolutely right. That was our editorial for today, making the same two points that we've let the NRA, its importance, supersede who they really are. You know, they have 5 million members. That's only 7% of gun owners. It's less than 2% of the nation's population. But they have become so powerful, frankly, because we and politicians have let them become so powerful. And also, to Tom's point on the Second Amendment, I mean, even conservative icon Antonin Scalia in the Heller decision wrote that the Second Amendment is not unlimited, that there can be restrictions placed on gun ownership. So as we move forward, I think we need to keep those things in mind. And I'm not naive in thinking all of a sudden we're going to have a rational discussion. But, every little bit helps. We know that it won't be a topic in the Maine legislature, be difficult to foresee anything happening in Congress. But, we need to just keep pushing so we can talk about all the solutions, including, mental health. Do we need more security at schools? But certainly guns need to be part of the discussion as well.
Sure. And I'll take one more call related to the gun issue. Greg and Green, go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking the call. I've been a physician in the state for 40 years and recently retired, so I can now listen to your program a lot more often. But the opioid issue has remained really important. And as a board member up at the Maine Medical Association, we take it very, very seriously. I just wanted to comment briefly that Governor LePage's approach just seems very simplistic at times. He was interviewed on your show, I think, a couple of weeks or so ago, and someone called in talking about Narcan saving lives, and he interrupted and said, it prolongs lives. And I just wanted to comment that, all our modern medical treatments basically prolong life. We don't really save lives. We prolong them. So it's just an example of how he's using, short phrases to try to get a moment to convert the dialogue from something complex to something simple. I also wanted to spend a minute talking about guns. The NRA is so potent because they're engaged and passionate on a continuous basis. It's not the size of the membership. And for us to counter that, we have to stay passionate and engaged over the long haul, and I think that's something that's been lacking. Also, I've heard recently a lot of commentary about, we can't introduce such and such a measure because there's no proof that that works. No one seems to be talking about the fact that the CDC was doing research on gun violence until 1996, when the Dickey Amendment was introduced to an omnibus spending bill, and it basically chilled the entire CDC research on gun violence by putting in a clause that said none of it could be used to advocate or promote gun control.
That's right.
Thanks, Greg. You know, I recently talked to a guy who lives in, I think, Harpswell, who a guy in his 70s, and told me, I don't really follow politics that much, but I just try to find out who's the most strongly committed to the Second Amendment, and I vote for them. And this guy's, you know, he's been voting every 2 years for 50 years using that that rule. And he has probably been getting his information about who's really behind, you know, the Second Amendment from groups like the NRA. And that is the power. I think that's we get lost in looking at how much they spend on lobbying or how much they donate to campaigns, which is significant. But a lot of other groups give more. What really is different is the way that they have a the hold that they have on their members and the way they can mobilize them.
Greg, thank you so much for your call. We have an email from Jonathan. Editorial in Portland Press Herald criticizes Maine's Ethics Commission for declining to investigate Jason Savage at the Maine Examiner. No mention of First Amendment, Citizens United guarantee of protected political speech. How come?
Well,
Actually, Greg, before you answer Jonathan's question, why don't you bring us up to speed on the Maine Examiner case?
Okay. So there was a news website called the Maine Examiner that was aggregating lots of articles and creating some articles, including some very critical of a candidate for mayor in Lewiston. And the site was totally anonymous. And these articles that were critical of Ben Chin, the Democratic candidate for mayor, were being circulated by local party officials and the state party through its website, the Maine GOP website. It turned out that the author of those articles was Jason Savage, who is the executive director of the state party, and he was the one who was publicizing them on the through the social media channels that belong to the Maine GOP, without acknowledging that he was also the person who wrote them. They were articles that corroborated what they were saying about this particular candidate. So this went to the Maine Ethics Commission, and the Ethics Commission took a look at it and determined that they weren't going to investigate it further. And Jason Savage's defense was, when I wrote those articles for the Examiner, I wasn't Jason Savage, the executive director of the state party. I was Jason Savage, the hobby journalist who in his spare time was creating, you know, journalism. What the commission decided was for a couple of reasons, they felt that they couldn't go into this case. And they didn't necessarily believe him in terms of I was punched out when I did it. But they apparently, first, you need to spend $250 to get their attention. And they didn't see him meeting that threshold. And they there's some question about whether they could have looked into something involving a local election, although I think they could have if it was the – because since it was the state party. So anyway, about the First Amendment issue, he has a First Amendment right to speak, and he has a First Amendment right to speak anonymously. The question is, does the party have the responsibility to circulate news – honestly, and that's a First Amendment issue, and that, you know, everybody has the right to free speech, but you also have consequences for it. And so he was trying to avoid the consequences by pretending that he wasn't the author.
Susan, do you think this is a harbinger of things to come with the upcoming elections?
Well, I think it highlights the need to update rules and laws around disclosure and around campaign and election practices. You know, the Ethics Commission and its rules were created at a time when we didn't have social media, we didn't have electronic media. So it highlights the need to bring those rules into the current times to address these kind of situations because, yeah, I believe, you know, this kind of thing will happen more and more frequently.
Thoughts, Ben?
Yeah, you know, when it was just newspapers and you had to have a printing press and a distribution system to print, make something that looks like a legitimate newspaper, then these problems didn't exist as much. But now you can create a site with for $5 or actually less than $250 apparently that looks just like any other news site and people will believe it. And so, you know, there's a whole question about whether a party should be doing that and what that means for that party, whether that's ethical and morally right or what they should be doing. And then there's the other side of it is being a good news consumer, which is a huge problem, a much broader problem than that. People just taking at face value what they read because it looks somewhat legitimate. And that's a big thing.
Yeah.
And then sharing it. And you see these things. I mean, I just saw a story today where a legislator, a U.S. congressman was repeating, you know, a fact that had been shared in a caucus meeting that had started on a far right wing website that was a lie, saying that the, you know, one of these airlines that's not going to give a discount to the NRA also gives discounts to Planned Parenthood, which isn't true. And was being disseminated on far right wing media. And here's this guy who is in a caucus meeting with other U.S. congressmen, and they're talking about this as if it's a fact. And he went on TV and he brought it up, like, what are they going to do about Planned Parenthood? And the host called him on it and said that's not true, and he didn't believe her. But so if you have people in a position like that, who are unable or unwilling, really. I mean, they want to believe what they see in front of them because it matches what they're what they want to think, how they see the world. But then what hope is it for everybody else? And if we're all working from different facts, it's going to be real difficult to have any sort of real discussion about the issues in this country.
We are talking about the news in February. We do have to take another quick break. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And before we go to break, a word about tomorrow's program. We're going to learn about how occupational therapy helps people live their lives more fully. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainpublic.org. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does MEMIC, proud to support the Maine High School Basketball Championship Weekend on Maine Public Television, March 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. MEMIC.com. On the next Speaking in Maine, the state of Europe after Brexit.
Since 2015, support for social democracy has fallen off a cliff.
The news of Europe's demise is exaggerated.
Matthew Goodwin and Natalie Nugarida discuss European foreign affairs at the recent 31st annual Camden Conference. This year's theme is New World Disorder and America's Future. That's on the next Speaking in Maine, this afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio. And you can always find Speaking in Maine episodes on our website, mainepublic.org. We'd like to give a special thanks to Robin from Fort Fairfield for donating her 2002 Pontiac Grand Am and her 1995 Chevrolet Corsica. Donations to the Maine Public Car Donation Program make a big difference for your public radio station, and you usually receive a tax deduction. Towing is free, and you can rest easy knowing that you gained extra mileage for the programming that you enjoy and count on. If you're thinking of what to do with your car, we hope you'll consider Maine Public. It's easy. Just visit mainepublic.org, click on support, and then the Maine Public Vehicle Donation Program. And thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we are talking about the news of the month. Joining me today Our panel of editorial page editors, Greg Kasich with the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram, Susan Young with the Bangor Daily News, and Ben Bragdon with the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number 1-800-399-3566. Greg, we still haven't talked about what was one of the farthest reaching stories of the month, which is L.L. Bean changing its famous return policy. This made national news.
It did. It did. And it made a lot of local news, or had a lot of reaction. It made me realize that we need to pay some more attention to L.L. Bean, because it's one of these organizations, institutions in Maine that doesn't seem to divide politically people on the left and the right, Republicans and Democrats. Were for the most part very supportive of the company and angry that you know, people would criticize it for doing something that a policy that people were taking advantage of.
Susan, for the Bangor Daily News, was this a story that had a lot of traction?
Absolutely. As Greg said, I mean, people were really fascinated by it for a whole host of reasons. And, you know, the backlash was interesting as well. Class action lawsuit filed by folks who kind of misunderstood that the policy was going forward, not retroactive, but angry that, you know, their products were supposed to be guaranteed for life. And, you know, how could the company do this? But, you know, it's a sad statement on human nature, too. I mean, folks on Facebook, you know, a little more privately sharing some of their stories. Somebody said they had a friend who had a shirt for 30 years and a button fell off, so he took it back to L.L. Bean. And, you know, we tend to take advantage of situations, and you can see why the company, for that reason, had to pare it back. My husband tells the story of someone showing up with a U-Haul full of furniture from a relative's house. The relative passed away and they didn't like the furniture, so they were hoping to return it. I don't think that one worked out.
We didn't guarantee that you're not going to die.
Right. Yeah, or that you just didn't like it. I mean, it worked perfectly well, but, you know, unfortunately, people took advantage of the situation, so they had to pare it back.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that they, I mean, this wasn't their first reaction to this problem. They, a few years back, I remember they worked with Goodwill to make sure that Goodwill put little marks on the L.L. Bean products, because people were going in and buying a $20 L.L. Bean jacket and then bringing it back and getting a new $500 one. And so they did that. They also changed for a short time where the question they would ask you, you know, they would ask you, they've always asked you, were you satisfied? And you say no, and they just went on with it. And then they kind of, some of them kind of added this, are you sure that you're not satisfied? You know, a little bit of guilt to go along with it. You know, which probably was enough to make people
say,
change
never
their
mind.
Behavior, right? But there was, you know, probably 10% of the people who were doing what Susan talked about, coming back with a leg from a table and asking for the whole table, but that guarantee and how people understood it, which was misunderstanding it a little bit, mm-hmm. was so closely connected with that company that some people, I guess, felt betrayed by it. I mean, it wasn't only if you used that so often, but that you knew that that if you bought something there and it didn't live up to its to what you thought it was going to be, that you could bring it back, which you still can, and that's the change. But it was a really interesting look into the psyche of the relationship between L.L. Bean and people in the state.
An email from Michael following up on the last question: how do the news editors deal with the fake news on their own medium? Do they censor editorials they know to be false or comments online they know to be untrue? If you get a letter, Greg, and it's, you know that it's got comments in it that are untrue, what do you do?
We don't run a letter that we know to be untrue. We try to run down the facts as much as we can. I'm not saying that we get 100% of them. But sometimes, you know, things do get biased. But if there's a fact that's not, readily available, we will call the writer up and say, you know, where did you get this one from? My colleague Sarah Collins does most of this, and just, you know, her hair is very curly, and it gets even curlier by the end of the day trying to run down these numbers. But so there's that. A lot of people. will write a letter that I think is perfectly reasonable, and then they'll cite a fact that I know is completely made up. You know, but it's just the world that we live in. People are getting their information from you know, they're not just getting it from multiple sources. They're getting it from only one source, but it's not the same one as, you know, the next guy gets it from.
Susan, same policy for the Bangor Daily News?
Yes. And it was interesting. We had a letter this week, someone trying to tell us the fact about guns, and went to the ATF website. And it turns out that some of his facts were, in fact, inaccurate. Mm-hmm. So we worked with him and took those sentences out of the letter. We did still run the letter. But if we had a letter that, you know, the bulk of it was inaccurate, we would just not use it at all.
Same, Ben?
Yeah, I try to work with people, if it's close, to get it there. But like Greg said, you know, I'll ask for verification. Where'd you get this number? And I'll look for it, and I can usually have an idea of where it came from. But and then they send me a news source that's not legitimate, and then, you know, we have to fight about that too. So that's a problem. But yeah, they have to, you know, you're entitled to your opinion, but not your own facts. And so, if you're going to put a number in there, you better make sure the number's right, just like we do with our editorials. You know, you can say what you want about our opinion, but the facts that we have in there are backed up and cited.
We'll go to Wade calling from Fairfield. Hi, Wade. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to back up the conversation on the issue. Everyone keeps quoting the Second Amendment saying it gives you unlimited right to or the right to unlimited gun ownership. But the amendment consists of four clauses, and it speaks of the well-regulated militia being necessary to protect the freedom of the country. That does not give people the right to unlimited gun ownership, and I'm really tired of the media not pushing back on that when people call in and say they have the right to unlimited gun ownership because of the Second Amendment. That's not what it says. Thank you.
Well, it's kind of that redefinition of the Second Amendment over the last few decades that is speaks to the NRA's power as well as its ability to kind of, you know, to change that conversation. So any attempt to do what a lot of people would say are common sense gun control bills can be painted as an attack on freedom. You know, this don't give them an inch type of philosophy that we see coming out of Congress most of the time.
You know, the founding fathers knew what a felon was, and they didn't prohibit them from owning guns, but Congress did decades ago, and it's never been challenged by the Supreme Court. It's totally constitutional under the Second Amendment. Machine guns used to be readily available, and there's a famous Susan. You know about that shootout in Bangor, downtown in the 1930s.
Right. Yeah.
You know, they were in town at the sporting goods store to buy machine guns.
Yeah.
And
the Brady gang.
And so they have been illegal since 1936. Or not illegal, but heavily regulated, and to the point where they're almost never used in crimes anymore. So he's absolutely right. The Second Amendment is not a prohibition of gun control.
Wade, thanks for your call. Let's see. We'll go to Leslie calling from Ellsworth. Hi, Leslie.
Hi. I was inspired to call by the caller who was talking about fake news. And I just wanted to mention the Ellsworth American, which is a paper that we read pretty regularly, has regular op-ed pieces by, Representative Lawrence Lockman, and then there's another a professor at Husson who does regular op-ed pieces for them, both making all kinds of specious claims. And I wondered, you know, what are the rules about things like that at other papers? And, you know, these are op-ed pieces, I understand. But, you know, what did your panel think of this? Thank you.
I mean, just as Greg said, with letters for op-eds, if the author is using a bunch of facts and figures that are untrue or simply asserting things with no backup documentation or data, we're not going to use those pieces. So I would actually suggest you contact the Ellsworth American and speak to the editor directly. I mean, there aren't media standards written down somewhere, but you know, we need to make sure that we're all accountable and that we're only running pieces that are factual and accurate.
Yeah, I always, you know, you have limited space and limited time. So I always ask, you know, what is this adding to the conversation? You know, just because there's a fringe opinion and it's out there doesn't mean we have to run it, although sometimes we do. It's really more about, like, what's our duty as a newspaper to give readers a full view of this issue, whatever issue it is. And these ones that are on the far end, they're not written to serve the discussion. They're written for other reasons, to inflame, misstate what the other side is saying. And I don't think that's adding anything to the conversation and getting people any closer to an understanding. So we try not to run those.
Before we go, we just have a couple minutes. Greg, I'm going to give you this one. Got, Senator King got what he wanted, a lobster emoji.
He got almost what he wanted. It was a lobster emoji missing a couple of feet. Okay, so I got to admit, I'm not following this story too carefully. Like, where do emojis come from? Who is there?
There's
like some...
actually a consortium. Yeah. There's an international consortium. Uh-huh. That
don't say we can't
the
solve the big problem.
right. So you petition the Unicode consortium, and they consider these petitions, and you have to have footnotes and, you know, really official looking documents before they decide whether to approve your emoji or not.
And they actually added a redhead this time. So, you know, after all this time, finally, some justice for the redheads out there.
Have any of you used the lobster
and a
emoji
mosquito?
Yet? A mosquito. Oh yeah, mosquito. Probably more appropriate, right?
I had a columnist who wanted to write a column with lots of emojis in it. And I had to say, no, it's just words, letters,
oh,
you know.
Greg.
I don't even want to try to figure out what
You're
it would
so
take.
You're so old school.
Oh, yeah.
Well, thank you all for coming back. Right. Susan Young, editorial page editor with the Bangor Daily News. Greg Kessich, editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. And Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor with the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. We had additional help from Rich Tozier. Owen Manahan took your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives at mainecalling.org. And this program will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and by Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, the role of occupational therapy. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.